Thank you, Charlene. We titled our talk, Why EPA Thinks the Resistance Monitoring for BT Crops is Important, and Where Do We Go From Here? And I certainly am going to try to answer those questions in my talk, but I'm also going to provide a broad overview of the current resistance monitoring programs we have in place for both BT corn and cotton, and also highlight some of the interesting results we've seen over the years. So first of all, where does resistance monitoring fit into the overall IRM strategy? From EPA's perspective, there are really two major components of IRM. First of all, there's the data and information that we look at and evaluate prior to registration of BT crops. These include things like the biology and ecology of the target pests, the dose or the amount of toxin expressed by the BT plant relative to the susceptibility of the target pests. Also, genetics of resistance, cross-resistance potential between multiple BT toxins, as well as simulation models to develop, refine, and evaluate potential refuge strategies. So once the registration is issued, we move into a post-registration phase. Certainly IRM doesn't end there. Some of the things we do after registration include grower education, compliance assurance, and also resistance monitoring. And certainly, if resistance was to occur under a worst-case scenario, a remedial action plan to contain the spread of resistance. So why does EPA think resistance monitoring is important? Well, first of all, IRM is a product stewardship plan that has a goal to maintain the efficacy of transgenic BT plants. So along those lines, the agency has stated that pest susceptibility to BT toxins is in the public good, and by that we're really getting at trying to preserve the benefits of BT crops, mainly the potential to reduce use of conventional insecticides. Okay. So the agency also reviews resistance monitoring as a proactive tool that can detect potential resistance before it would reach the level of field failure. Populations that are suspected of resistance can be investigated to determine whether it's truly a case of resistance or maybe there's some other factor involved. IRM plans can be adjusted if necessary based on data from resistance monitoring. And again, under a worst case scenario where we do confirm that there is resistance, a remedial action plan can be implemented. Finally, resistance monitoring can serve as a tool to help us evaluate IRM strategies and help us answer the question as to whether refuges, either structured refuges or natural refuges, really do delay the onset of resistance. So in the next few slides, I want to provide an overview of the structure of the resistance monitoring plans that have been implemented. First of all, what do we monitor? Resistance monitoring is required for the major target pests. Those would be the ones that are capable of creating or causing the most economic damage to BT crops in the continental United States. And I'm going to talk more specifically about what insects we do monitor a little later in the talk. There are really two levels of monitoring that are part of IRM. The first is a more basic level of monitoring, and that would be grower reports of unexpected damage. So if a farmer is scouting their field and they notice that they've got large larvae in the BT portion of the field, something that they wouldn't expect to see, they're then obligated to report that to the registrant, who can then investigate that population to determine whether it's a case of resistance or something else is involved. The second level of monitoring is a random population sampling. Samples are taken for each of the target pests over the geographic range of the pest. Typically, the sampling focuses on areas of highest adoption of BT crops. These insects that are sampled are then returned to the laboratory. They're typically reared up, and progeny from those collections are then tested with bioassays to detect shifts in susceptibility or potential resistance. So looking a little more closely at these laboratory bioassays that are used, there have been two primary detection techniques that have been used. The first are baseline susceptibility determinations, which are usually LC50 values. And these can be used to compare field-collected populations with susceptible lab strains, or they can be compared with field collections that were made in previous growing seasons. There's also the use of discriminating or diagnostic concentration assays. These are typically based on an LC99. And the idea with these is to be able to distinguish susceptible insects, those who most likely won't survive the diagnostic concentration, and potentially resistant insects that that might be able to survive that high concentration. So now what happens when these laboratory assays detect a potential problem population? This would trigger then a series of follow-up investigations to confirm whether these populations are in fact resistant. Some of the steps that are part of that process include determining whether this tolerance trait is heritable, determining whether population is capable of surviving on actual BT plant tissue, either leaf discs or whole plants. There's a determination whether the trait is dominant or recessive. An estimate of the resistance allele frequency can be made. You can determine whether the frequency of this allele is increasing and if there's a geographic boundary to the resistance allele distribution. And these confirmation steps are really an important part of the resistance monitoring program, and that'll become apparent, I think, in a few slides later in this talk. I'd like to focus the next portion of the talk going over some of the specific monitoring plans that we have in place for corn and cotton. I'll start with corn, and I think as everybody knows, there are two major types of BT corn that have been registered. The first is targeted at lepidopteran pests, the major pests of which are European corn borer, southwestern corn borer, and corn earworm, and those are the three insects that are included in the annual monitoring program for lepidopteran corn. There are two toxins that have been registered targeting LEPs. These are Cry1AB, that's been registered since 1995, and Cry1F, which was registered in 2000. The second type of corn is targeted at Coleoptera, the corn rootworm pest complex. There have been three toxins that have been registered for control of corn rootworm. These are Cry3BB1, Cry3435, and modified Cry3A, and all three of these toxins have been registered in the past 4 years. For the most part, monitoring program for corn rootworm is still under development, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a few slides. Okay, now this next slide shows the areas in which lepidopteran sampling has been targeted. Now this map here is it's a bit old, it's from 2002, but the general patterns of BT crop adoption I think still hold true. And the areas that are circled here, the red areas here, the red circles here are where European corn borer sampling has been targeted. This black circle here is where southwestern corn borer and European corn borer have been sampled, and then this little blue circle here is where southwestern corn borer has been sampled. Corn earworm sampling has, in the past, typically been done in more southern regions where cotton is also grown, since it's a pest on both corn and cotton. Okay, so what have we found over the years? This next slide that I've included here has a table that summarizes the 12 years of data that we've tabulated for European corn borer and Cry1AB, and this is all work that's been done by Dr. Blair Siegfried at the University of Nebraska. I apologize if this slide isn't readable in the back. I'll try to walk through it a little bit here. On the left side are summarized LC50 values. This would be the baseline susceptibility determinations from field collected populations every year since 1995 through 2006. I think the more interesting part of this table is on the right hand side, and this is the average percent mortality to the diagnostic concentration that's been used. For just about every year, the average mortality has been greater than 99%, which is what you would expect to see on an LC99 based diagnostic concentration. However, I've highlighted in blue 2 years, 2001 and 2004, in which there was survival that was less than, or there was a mortality that was less than 99%. Which might be an indication that there could be some sort of a tolerance issue, and I'm going to go into those specific cases in the next few slides here. Okay, the first of what I'm calling these European corn borer populations of interest was a population, actually three populations that were sampled in Candiohee County in Minnesota during the 2001 growing season. These insects were tested at the diagnostic concentration and showed some slight survival, higher than expected survival, They had 97.8 to 98.5% mortality, so it's a little less than the 99% mortality that would have been expected. So the researchers took the survivors from those diagnostic concentrations, the few that did survive, reared them up, and conducted some follow-up testing on that colony. And the long and the short of the follow-up testing, the population did not show the ability to survive on actual Cry1AD plant tissue. So it's extremely unlikely that this was really a truly resistant population that was sampled. In addition, monitoring has been conducted in subsequent growing seasons since 2001 in Candiohee County, and there's been no evidence to show that there's any elevated tolerance to Cry1AD. In the second case, from 2004, one population was sampled in Hamilton County, Iowa. And this population was tested on both Cry1AB and Cry1F, and exhibited a much higher survival than would have been expected. In fact, the survival is roughly 50% for both toxins. So as was done with Candiohee County, follow-up testing was initiated on this population for both Cry1AB and Cry1F. For Cry1AB, like Candiohee County, it was found that the population was unable to tolerate Cry1AB corn plants. So it's again unlikely that this was a truly Cry1AB resistant population. However, for Cry1F, testing showed that there was in fact a heritable trait, a single recessive gene, and furthermore that progeny from this colony could survive on Cry1F plants to adulthood. So this is clearly something that's a little more tolerant than we had seen with Cry1AB. However, it should be noted that there have been no reports of field failure either on Cry1AB corn or Cry1F corn in Hamilton County. And the additional monitoring has been conducted in 2005, 2006, and I believe probably 2007, although we haven't seen the data yet. But there's been no evidence of any increased tolerance to Cry1AB or Cry1F, so it's unclear as far as Cry1F goes really what happened there, but it has not been reproduced since then. Oops. So in addition to the Candiohee and Hamilton County results, there was another population that was collected in Jefferson County, Nebraska last year. This population, when tested on Cry1F, had slightly less mortality than would have been expected. They had a little over 3% survival at the diagnostic concentration. So as with the other European corn borer populations, follow-up testing was initiated. Follow-up testing was initiated from survivors. Progeny from the survivors were then tested again at the diagnostic concentration. In this case, it showed a little higher survival, roughly 33% survival at the original diagnostic concentration. A second diagnostic concentration at 10 times the level was also tested, and in this case, no survival was found. Tests on Cry1F leaf discs showed low survival and growth inhibition, so it's unlikely that this population would be able to survive on Cry1F corn in the field. And like Candiohee and Hamilton County, this county will be targeted for additional sampling in future growing seasons. Now, aside from the European corn borer populations, EPA has also received a report regarding an event in Puerto Rico with fall armyworm. Now, fall armyworm is a secondary pest of corn in the United States and is not part of the annual monitoring program that we have for BT corn in the continental U.S. However, in Puerto Rico, fall armyworm is probably the primary pest of corn. So, in this case, there were three locations in which unexpected damage by fall armyworm feeding was observed during 2006. So fall armyworm were collected from these sites, returned to the lab, tested on various Cry1F concentrations, and it was shown that there was no significant mortality to these fall armyworms, even at the highest Cry1F concentration tested, which was 10,000 nanograms Cry1F per centimeter squared. Okay. So Puerto Rico really presents perhaps a worst-case scenario for insect resistance management. It's a closed island population. There's continual corn production throughout the year. Very high pest pressure. There were drought conditions in 2006 that likely funneled fall armyworm through into irrigated corn from other hosts that they might also have been on. And the pest also has high larval movement, which all likely contributed to this tolerance that was observed. So the registrants initiated a series of voluntary remedial action measures to attempt to control the situation. First, alternate control measures were used, conventional insecticides. And secondly, and perhaps the most important part, was they discontinued the commercial cultivation of Crown F corn in Puerto Rico. Now, although this is the first documented instance of pest survival on BT corn in the field, there should be an overall low risk to Cryo-1F corn in the continental United States, first of all, because fall armyworm is a secondary pest, and also because of the population dynamics and overwintering biology of the pest. It's only capable of overwintering in the extreme southern part of the U.S., the very southern part of Florida and the very southern part of Texas, so it's unlikely that it would be able to establish a foothold in the U.S. Nonetheless, this is certainly a significant finding in our resistance monitoring program. I want to turn to the cotton side. There have been, of course, three toxins that are registered for with BT cotton targeting Lepidoptera. These are Cry1AC. It's been registered since 1996. Cry2AB2, which has been registered since 2003, and Cry1F, which has been registered since 2005. There are two major production zones for cotton. In the southeastern U.S., the target pests are tobacco budworm and cotton bollworm. And in the southwestern U.S., the target pest is pink bollworm. And all three of these insects are part of the annual resistance monitoring for BT cotton. So this next slide I've included as an example of how sampling sites are selected for cotton. In this case, this is for tobacco budworm, and the sites have been targeted based on adoption of BT cotton. I think these are overall cotton acreages here, and also areas where, based on our natural refuge assessment, where natural refuge might be a little bit lower. We're going to have to really speed through this now. Okay, just to go over the results really quickly, the bottom line and the good news for cotton is there's been no documented cases of field resistance to date. There was one collection of pink bollworm in 1997 that did survive a diagnostic concentration. Resistance allele frequency was estimated to be 0.16. That's fairly high. However, we have not seen reduced Cry1AC susceptibility or field effects since this collection, and subsequent estimates of the resistance allele frequency have been much lower, 0.004. I think I'm going to skip over the cotton bollworm part here because Dr. Luttrell will be giving a talk a little later in the symposium where he'll be going over his data, and I think he can probably do a better job discussing his data than me, so I'll skip that part. Just to go over some of the challenges that we've been facing with resistance monitoring, some of the pests are a little harder to monitor than others, as we've seen with fall armyworm in Puerto Rico. Some of the secondary pests can present a challenge, so we have to ask the question, how do we monitor secondary pests and what happens if we do find resistance? Cotton bollworm has been a challenge because it's less susceptible to BT toxins, and it's been very difficult to develop a diagnostic concentration for the pest. Corn rootworm, again, this is one that's a really tough one to rear in the lab, and diet bioassays would certainly be a tough thing for this. So alternate approaches to monitoring may be needed for both of these pests. Other challenges are more logistical, resource challenges, both financial and time. Academic cooperators certainly can be challenged by the amount of time that they need to devote to doing monitoring. Methodology has presented a challenge in having consistent procedures and getting consistent output. Having available toxins to test and monitoring has been an issue. As well as the sampling methodology, which, as I mentioned before, is focused on areas of highest adoption. But there's always the possibility of missing something if you have either recessive resistance or very low resistance allele frequencies. So where do we go from here? Certainly we can improve our sampling, focusing on areas that present the greatest suction pressure resistance risk. We need to be able to follow up on populations that may show elevated tolerance to BT toxins, either on diagnostic concentrations or other measures. We can look at developing improved monitoring techniques with greater sensitivity. Pyramided crops have certainly been seems to be the direction BT crops are going, and with multiple toxins, that's something we need to be able to address, and other cropping systems that may be out there. And with that, I will finish up, and sorry for running over. Do we have time for questions? Or
well, we're
maybe one.